Columbian camp to our 11th study period at 10 o'clock on Monday morning. And what a beautiful Monday morning it is, with the sun shining so bright and clear outside. The lovely atmosphere we have of happiness and peace amongst us this morning. Now, last night we introduced the theme of Jacob's trouble, and we'll now spend time studying, first of all, the experience of Jacob in the Old Testament, and then in turn the parallels to this in the final showdown between the powers of darkness and the powers of light. Now, I must say that personally, as I've reviewed this story during this year in the camp meetings in Germany and California, I've come to understand the mystery of our mission as never before, and to realize more accurately and clearly the real nature of the conflict to be fought out during the time of Jacob's trouble. Now, while it may seem a little repetitious perhaps, we will spend a little time in reviewing the early life of Jacob and Esau, because the development of their relationship is a clear picture of the development of the relationship, which will take place again as we move on down toward the end of time. And so I turn to page 177 in the book Patriarchs and Prophets. We read last night, of course, the scripture reference in Genesis chapter 25 that reported the birth of these two boys, twin brothers. And now we find on page 177 these words in regard to these two young men. Jacob and Esau, the twin sons of Isaac, present a striking contrast both in character and in life. This unlikeness was foretold by the angel of God before their birth. So obviously they were not identical twins, they were
fraternal.
Not the word, is it? That's why you know the word so well, huh?
Yeah.
No twins in my family, so I wasn't familiar with that. When in answer to Rebekah's troubled prayer, he declared that two sons would be given her. He opened to her their future history, that each would become the head of a mighty nation, but that one would be greater than the other, that the younger would have the preeminence. We must remember that just as certainly as Jacob was a type, Esau was also a type. And the confrontation between these two brothers, which went on for most of their lives, is also a type of the confrontation between the antitypical Jacob, or Jacob's people, and the antitypical Esau people down in the last days. I think in the past we tended to look only at Jacob, and think in terms of his experience and struggle in the time called Jacob's trouble on the one side, but we need to recognize that Esau is just as much a type as Jacob was, and we have to look for and find the antitype of Esau, or the Esau people, down in this last period of this earth's history. And of course, as those two brothers, they were very opposite from each other, so in the last days, these two people should be very opposite from each other as well. Now let's see what the opposites were. Esau grew up loving self-gratification and centering all his interests in the present. Impatient of restraint, he delighted in the wild freedom of the chase and early chose the life of a hunter. Yet he was the father's favorite. Let's go back over these words now. Esau grew up loving self-gratification and centering all his interests in the present. Now, if you think about the present world around about us, if you think about the trend of modern amusements, the accent found in modern advertising, the outreach of modern man, then would you say that this modern generation outside of this movement is a generation which loves self-gratification? Absolute, doesn't it? Every comfort, every invention that men can conceive is all designed to make life easier, more pleasant, more indulgent, and so forth. And how much real thought is given by modern men for the responsibilities of the future? None worth talking about. Life is for the present, and the cry is, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Now, it says he was impatient of restraint. So what kind of spirit did he have in him? Right, the spirit of disobedience, which of course in turn marks the general character of modern mankind. I emphasize these points to demonstrate the fact that Esau was indeed a type of a people who live today, the people outside of God's true church. It then says he delighted in the wild freedom of the chase and early chose the life of a hunter, now, or a killer or a destroyer. What one word would you use to describe all that? He delighted in what? In excitement. Okay, does modern man also seek exciting things to do? Right, and the more exciting the movie or the television show, the more popular that thing becomes, right? And so all these make it very, very clear then that Esau was a very, very clear type of the people who are living at the present time, outside of the fold of God. Now this, we'll find that this likeness between Esau and the Esau people of today goes on a little further, a little later in the reading. Yet he was the father's favourite, which of course is a very strange thing, Isaac being who he was. The quiet, peace-loving shepherd was attracted by the daring and vigour of his elder son, who fearlessly ranged over mountain and desert, returning home with game for his father and with exciting accounts of his adventurous life. Now we turn to Jacob. Jacob, thoughtful, diligent and caretaking, ever thinking more of the future than the present, was content to dwell at home, occupied in the care of the flocks and the tillage of the soil. His patient perseverance, thrift and foresight were valued by the mother. His affections were deep and strong, and his gentle, unremitting attentions added far more to her happiness than did the boisterous and occasional kindnesses of Esau. To Rebekah, Jacob was the dearest son. Let's come back now to look at the character of Jacob. He was thoughtful, diligent and caretaking, ever thinking more of the future than the present, and was content to dwell at home, occupied in the care of the flocks and the tillage of the soil. Now, is this a picture now of God's true people at the present time? Are we more concerned about the future than the present? What are we doing here otherwise? Why have we turned our backs upon all the exciting places of the world to go back to school? Because that is, of course, where we are this morning. We're in a classroom, we're in school, and we're well aware of the fact that the average young person today longs for the day when school ends and never wants to go back as long as he lives. Yeah, we've all gone back to school, turned our backs upon the pleasures of the present to prepare for the duties and responsibilities of tomorrow. And so the work of preparation is going on in the hearts of all you students around the world, while at the same time the Esau people are building up a character or a lack of it for their role in the final conflict in the last days. Now a little further on page 177, the promises made to Abraham and confirmed to his son were held by Isaac and Rebekah as the great object of their desires and hopes. With these promises, Esau and Jacob were familiar. They were taught to regard the birthright as a matter of great importance, for it included not only an inheritance of worldly wealth but spiritual preeminence. He who received it was to be the priest of his family, and in the line of his posterity the Redeemer of the world would come. On the other hand, there were obligations resting upon the possessor of the birthright. He who should inherit its blessings must devote his life to the service of God. Like Abraham, he must be obedient to the divine requirements in marriage, in his family relations, in public life. He must consult the will of God. Now, how much interest did Esau have in those spiritual responsibilities? None whatsoever. But he wanted and was determined to have as his right the material blessings of the birthright. He wanted the wealth of his father, he wanted the power that inheritance would pass on to him, and he was very much determined to have that part of the birthright. I'll read a little further now. Isaac made known to his sons these privileges and conditions, and plainly stated that Esau, as the eldest, was the one entitled to the birthright. But Esau had no love for devotion, no inclination to a religious life. The requirements that accompanied the spiritual birthright were an unwelcome and even hateful restraint to him. The law of God, which was the condition of the divine covenant with Abraham, was regarded by Esau as a yoke of bondage. Bent on self-indulgence, he desired nothing so much as liberty to do as he pleased. To him, power and riches, feasting and reveling were happiness. He gloried in the unrestrained freedom of the wild, of his wild roving life. Rebekah remembered the words of the angel, and she read with clearer insight than did her husband the character of their sons. She was convinced that the heritage of divine promise was intended for Jacob. She repeated to Isaac the angel's words, but the father's affections were centered upon the elder son, and he was unshaken in his purpose. Now those the thoughts in that paragraph, of course, once again describe the way that the modern person lives. How frequently you hear out there in the religious world that the law of God is a yoke of bondage. Sabbath keeping and so forth, morality as you find in the law of God, are all to be cast aside as a restriction on liberties, and people can't do what they want to do because of that law, and so they cast it right aside. Now, Jacob had learned from his mother of a divine intimation that the birthright should fall to him, and he was filled with an unspeakable desire for the privileges that which it would confer. It was not the possession of his father's wealth that he craved. The spiritual birthright was the object of his longing, to commune with God as did righteous Abraham, to offer the sacrifice of atonement for his family, to be the progenitor of the chosen people and the promised Messiah, and to inherit the immortal possessions embraced in the blessings of the covenant. Here were the privileges and honors that kindled his most ardent desires. His mind was ever reaching forward to the future and seeking to grasp its unseen blessings. With secret longing, he listened to all that his father told concerning the spiritual birthright. He carefully treasured what he had learned from his mother. Day and night, the subject occupied his thoughts until it became the absorbing interest of his life. But while he thus esteemed eternal above temporal blessings, Jacob had not an experimental knowledge of the God whom he revered. His heart had not been renewed by divine grace. Now, what a strange statement it is, because you think that when a person had an all-consuming desire to receive the spiritual blessing of the birthright, you think he must surely have been born again. But the statement plainly says his heart had not been renewed by divine grace. He did not yet have an experimental knowledge of the will and command of God. He had not learned the principle of asking only two questions: what are my orders and what are the promises? And this is the reason why, of course, he joined with his mother in that scheme to dispossess his brother of the birthright. I read further. He believed that the promise concerning himself could not be fulfilled so long as Esau retained the rights of the firstborn. Now listen carefully. And he constantly studied to devise some way whereby he might secure the blessing which his brother held so lightly and which was so precious to himself. Now, all the trouble in Jacob's life stemmed from that fact, that he continually studied to devise some way whereby he might secure the blessing to himself. Okay? Now, what should he have done? Well, he should have left that in God's care, because if we go back to the beginning, we have, first of all, so far as Jacob is concerned, he had the promise which was given in the prophecy, the promise of God that he would be given that birthright, that he was the one who would receive it. His mother had been told this by the angel, and the mother had imparted the same words to him, and Jacob knew as well as his mother did what the promise of God was. And having the promise of God, he should have rested then in the assurance that God would do his work. Now, when God makes a promise, God will fulfill that promise. But instead we find that his mind was continually trying to figure out ways to devise a plan whereby he could gain that birthright for himself. So he was continually devising. Let's just put the word devising, or if you like, the word planning, scheming, right? Working at the business of finding out how he could make God's promise become his own personal possession. Now, therefore, at this point of time, did Jacob as yet understand the Sabbath rest principles? No, he didn't. He did not understand them. He didn't live them. And because he didn't live them, he was not enjoying the peace and rest which he ought to have been enjoying at this point of time. Now, the only possible outcome of this devising and planning was that he built up for himself a tremendous, tremendous trouble. And Jacob's trouble at the book Jabbok was the direct result. There's nothing else but that his own personal devising and planning which brought that trouble upon him at the book Jabbok. The whole thing coalesced or came into focus at that point of time. Now this obviously means then that today, if we learn to put away all human devising and planning and let God alone be our plan maker, does that mean we'll have an easier time during Jacob's trouble? Definitely. Most definitely. As I read to you last night, those who exercise but little faith now. Now, of course, it takes large faith to give up devising and planning, doesn't it? It takes large faith. That requires you to put away all fear that God can't do his work, and to rest in the fact he will do his work. And therefore, if we don't exercise faith now, which means, that is, a lack of exercising faith means devising and planning on the human being's part, then the greater shall be the time of trouble when it comes upon us in the future. Shall I read the statement again from Great Controversy, where we have that very, very clear warning given to us in regard to the trouble that shall befall the people of God when that time comes? Page 622, Great Controversy. Those who exercise but little faith now. Let's say it in different words. Those who spend a lot of time devising and planning now. I mean the same thing, right? If you exercise little faith, you do much devising and planning. So those who do much devising and planning now are in the greatest danger of falling under the power of satanic delusions and the decree to compel the conscience. And even if they endure the test, they will be plunged into deeper distress and anguish in a time of trouble because they have never made it a habit to trust in God. The lessons of faith which they have neglected, they will be forced to learn under a terrible pressure of discouragement. Now those are words worth remembering, aren't they? Because when that time of Jacob's trouble comes, it's going to be no Sunday afternoon picnic. And when that time comes, you will be saying that too. And therefore, the easier we can make that time for ourselves by doing a thorough work of deep preparation today, then of course the kinder our experience is going to be at that point of time. So let's not forget now that a very, very dominant point in the life of Jacob, a rather sad life too in many respects, was that, as I read on page 179, Patriarchs and Proverbs, he constantly studied to devise some way whereby he might secure the blessing which his brother held so lightly and which was so precious to himself. And I can imagine Jacob going to bed at night and laying there with his head on the pillow thinking, what can I do? You know, just figuring out some way to get that birthright. Can't you imagine the picture?
No.
That's right. You wake up in the morning and all the next day he'd be chipping away in the garden, but he would be thinking about that brother Esau. How can I get that birthright? How can I get that birthright? How can I get that birthright? I guess he did come up with some weird and wonderful plans. And then, of course, one day Esau came staggering in, faint and weary from the chase, asking for the food that Jacob was preparing, and Jacob said to himself, the opportunity. This is it. Now I shall trade off the birthright for a mess of pottage. And he did it successfully too, which is the amazing thing. It certainly shows to what extent Esau must be the slave of appetite and self-indulgence for him to so readily say, sure, I'm going to die anyway if I don't have food, so what shall this birthright profit me? You can have it, and I'll have the food. And so Esau despised his birthright. Now, of course, I guess that Jacob was very, very well aware of the fact that Esau had no intention of regarding this deal or this arrangement being very binding. Because if he had, Esau should have said to his father, look, I'm sorry, Dad, but I sold that birthright to Jacob several years ago now, and I don't even have the right to it anymore. But when Isaac said to Esau, go out and catch some venison and bring it in here, we'll have a little feast together, and I'll bestow the birthright upon you, Esau said, okay, I'll go and do that. So how much respect did Esau have to his own covenant with Jacob? None whatsoever. There was no honor. There was no integrity in that young man worth talking about. He was not trustworthy in any sense of the word at all. Now, there were three counts at least on which Esau had lost his right to the birthright. The first one was the fact that he had no interest in spiritual things whatsoever. That's the first one. He didn't esteem the spiritual responsibility and didn't prepare himself to bear those responsibilities. The second point was he carelessly sold the birthright to his brother. And the third one was he married two daughters of Heth, who of course were heathen women. Took two wives of the daughters of Heth. Now Heth were Canaanites and heathen, they were worshippers of false gods, and their idolatry was a bitter grief to Isaac and Rebekah. So that was the third count. Then, well, four counts, really, polygamy was one, marrying two wives, and the fourth count was, of course, he married heathen wives. And so on those four counts, he had no right to the birthright anymore whatsoever. And yet the father still insisted he would give to Esau the blessing of the birthright. Now, it was the custom back in those days, apparently, for the birthright to be bestowed in a kind of a festive atmosphere. A very, very nice feast would be prepared. All the family would be called in, including, no doubt, cousins and uncles and grandparents and whatever. And then, as the feast progressed, the father would eventually call all the folk to order. There'd be a very solemn atmosphere. And then, with the great ceremony, the father would invoke the blessing on the eldest son, usually, sometimes perhaps on another son, but almost always on the eldest son. And then everyone would respect the fact that this young man was the true heir to his father's wealth and the future priest of the household. But because of the divided home in which Isaac found himself, this ceremony was not conducted as a family affair. And he kept putting it off, hoping that someday it could be done without too much opposition. But as the years went by, of course, we find that Rebecca and Jacob became more determined to have the birthright taken away from Esau. And so finally Isaac, who was getting rather old, had become quite blind, decided that he'd better do something about this before he passed away and the birthright never be conferred. And so he decided of a secret feast, just he and Esau being present. But unfortunately, unfortunately for him, well, I suppose fortunately for him, really, because he was safe from transgressing God's will, tents are very thin walls which don't have very good sound dampening qualities. So there was a ready transmission of Isaac's voice, and Rebecca heard it all. And no doubt she had been like a watchful eagle, and never let herself get too far away from Isaac's side, because she knew, she suspected that some way, somehow, someday this was going to happen, and sure enough it did. And so we read on page 179, years passed on until Isaac, old and blind and expecting soon to die, determined no longer to delay the bestowal of the blessing upon his elder son. But, knowing the opposition of Rebekah and Jacob, he decided to perform the solemn ceremony in secret. In accordance with the custom of making a feast upon such occasions, the patriarch bade Esau, go out to the field and take me some venison and make me some savoury meat that my soul may bless thee before I die. Rebekah divined his purpose. She was confident that it was contrary to what God had revealed as his will. Isaac was in danger of incurring a divine displeasure and of debarring his younger son from the position to which God had called him. She had in vain tried the effect of reasoning with Jacob, and she determined to resort to stratagem. Now, I said earlier in the week that probably the most reliable safeguard that you have got against temptation and sin and against doing the wrong thing is to ask the question, what are my orders? Now, if Isaac had asked the simple question, what are my orders in regard to this birthright business, what would the answer have been? Give it to Jacob, right? And if he'd obeyed the orders, there'd be no trouble, would there? No trouble whatsoever. Now, in the same terms, if Rebekah had asked the question, what are my orders, would she found any orders instructing her to practice deception upon her husband? No, and in the absence of orders, what do you do? Nothing. Which, of course, is the hardest thing for human beings to do. Well, certainly she rationalized. We always... Certainly. Certainly. But that rationale is not, in God's sight, a justification for such a course of action. We always rationalize. We always say, well, now, the end is very good. In other words, I've got to save my husband from breaking the law of God. I've got to save the cause of God from having Esau as the high priest of the family. I've got to make sure that Jacob becomes the progenitor of the divine seed and all those things. And therefore, because the desired results are very good, this justifies in the mind of the person the means used to achieve those ends. But does the end justify the means? No, it doesn't. It never does. And there is another procedure to be followed in this situation. And the procedure was for her to go away by herself and say, now, Lord, you have promised that birthright to Jacob. Therefore, it's your responsibility to see that he gets that birthright. I have no orders to do this myself. That's your responsibility, and I'm not going to take over your responsibility. Now, if she'd done that, then God, in his own wonderful way, would have solved the problem. It's very possible that a very frustrated Esau would have come back from the hunt with nothing in his hands. That's very possible. All the deer and whatever else may have become suddenly very expert at dodging him. I can imagine the frustration if he came back with nothing, or he may have been injured and been laid up for weeks and weeks in a distant place. There's lots and lots of things which could have happened. In fact, in Desire of Ages, page 330, Sister White there says that God has 1,000 ways to provide for us of which we know nothing. 1,000 ways. And so Rebekah should simply have said, now, Lord, that is your responsibility, that is your problem. You made the promise and you have to carry it out. That is your responsibility. And we rest the entire case entirely in your care, and we'll do only what you give us orders to do and nothing else but that. And one of those 1,000 ways in which we know nothing, God would have saved the situation and the birthright would have gone to Jacob, not to Esau. And of course, then there would never have been a time of Jacob's trouble, as we shall learn as we move along. And so Rebekah then went to Jacob, who was most reluctant at first to participate in the scheme, but mother's authority prevailed over him, plus the fact that he too was deeply concerned about losing that birthright. And the end result was that he acquiesced to her plan, went in before his father. No more, it must be a nerve-wracking experience. I'd be just trembling with fear in case Dad found me out. Wouldn't you? But he carried it off very well, apparently, and I'm sure that when the father said, let me feel your arms, he just presented the last little bit of them so the dad could rub his hands and avoided the father finding the stitches, for instance, and so forth. And, of course, the father says, sounds like Jacob's voice, but you say it's Esau, so Esau it must be, and you come back so quickly, I can't really believe all this. Now, When Esau came back and found that his brother had taken the birthright from him, then of course Esau, with the mind of an unconverted man, didn't simply say, well, I deserved it. After all said and done, I have disqualified myself from the birthright. I married heathen wives. I've never made myself ready to take these responsibilities. So look, God's will be done. Everything is as it should be. Now, can you imagine Esau saying those kind of words? Hardly. The unconverted never, ever say those kind of words. The unconverted think of only one thing. They are the losers in the deal. And therefore, the person who has deprived them of what they hold most dear in this world is then regarded by them as being a threat to them, a danger and a threat to them. And when men of violence find someone else as being a threat to them, they have only one thought, and that is to get rid of that threat. And the way to do it, of course, is to kill that person. Because very obviously, of course, if Jacob is dead, then the birthright must come back to Esau again, and he will get the father's wealth and the father's possessions. And Jacob was forced to flee for his very life from the presence of his angry brother. Now, at this point, I want to start drawing a parallel between the lead-up. What we're studying here so far is the lead-up to the time of Jacob's trouble in the type. I want now to begin to look at the lead-up to the time of Jacob's trouble in the antitype. So we can parallel these two great events and find that much the same adventures are happening to God's folk at the present time, or building up towards the same thing at the present time as happened back there in the past. Right, now let's turn to the great controversy again. And there's a chapter entitled The Impending Conflict. And what does the word impending mean? It's coming, right. And in the life story of the original Jacob, we've been studying the events which were leading up to the impending conflict when they finally met near the book Jabbok. Page 582 to begin with. That's where the chapter starts on page 582. Great controversy. And the first paragraph points out that the basis of the great controversy has always been the law of God. From the very beginning of the great controversy in heaven, it has been Satan's purpose to overthrow the law of God. It was to accomplish this that he entered upon his rebellion against the Creator. And though he was cast out of heaven, he has continued the same warfare upon the earth. To deceive men and thus lead them to transgress God's law is the object which he has steadfastly pursued. Whether this be accomplished by casting aside the law altogether or by rejecting one of its precepts, the result will be ultimately the same. He who offends in one point manifests contempt for the whole law. His influence and example are on the side of transgression. He becomes guilty of all. James 2 and verse 10. Pardon me. In seeking to cast contempt upon the divine statutes, Satan has perverted the doctrines of the Bible, and errors have thus been incorporated into the faith of thousands who profess to believe the Scriptures. The last great conflict between truth and error is but the final struggle in the long-standing controversy concerning the law of God. Upon this battle we are now entering, a battle between the laws of men and the precepts of Jehovah, between the religion of the Bible and the religion of fable and tradition. All right, let's now just examine this development in detail, because it is a very, very clear picture of the spirit of Esau, which of course was the spirit of disobedience. We read from Ephesians the second chapter about the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience. Remember that text, Ephesians 2, verse 1 to 3. Now, from the beginning, Satan has been at war with the law of God, and he maintains that this law is a restriction of human liberties, and he calls for its abolition. He wants it to be done away with completely. Now, the last great conflict between truth and error is but the final struggle of the long-standing controversy concerning the law of God. Upon this battle we are now entering, a battle between the laws of men and the precepts of Jehovah, between the religion of the Bible and the religion of fable and tradition. Now, prior to 1844, the apostatizing Protestant churches still were very strong preachers of the law of God. Now, of course, they kept Sunday, as we know, but at that time the light on Sabbath reform had not yet broken upon the world, and therefore their Sunday keeping was accepted by God in many instances as Sabbath keeping. When a genuine born-again Christian back there kept Sunday and kept it very, very well as a true Sabbath day, then God accepted that as the best that they knew. Of course, the majority of Protestants were anything but Christians, They were worldlings, as the 1844 message very strongly and plainly showed. So prior to 1844 then, we find that the Protestant churches were quite strong on preaching the law of God. Now, when the first angel's message came, followed by the second angel and the third angel immediately after October 22, 1844, the first angel brought the everlasting gospel, and the Protestant churches rejected that everlasting gospel. And when they turned down the gospel as brought them in the first angel's message, they could not under any circumstances accept the light of the second angel. And therefore they could not in turn accept the light of the third angel. And you'll read that in the chapter in the little book of early writings entitled A Firm Platform. I think it begins on page 269. I won't take time to read the reference this morning because I think we've read it before. But I will just refer your minds to it again. It's, where is it now? It should be page 269, as I remember. Yes, page 260, page 258. It starts on page 258. And 259 is where it deals with this parallel between the experience of the Jews back in Christ's day and the Protestant churches back in 1844. And makes it very plain that all those who rejected the first angel's message could not be benefited by the second or the third. Now, the third angel's message, of course, brought to view the seventh-day Sabbath, along with other great principles of truth, including the sanctuary message of Christ's ministry in the most holy place of the heavenly sanctuary. Now, it was impossible for the Protestant churches to accept the Sabbath truth when they had rejected the truth which led up to the Sabbath truth, right? So now they were in a dilemma. And the dilemma was that they professed to be Bible-believing Christians, and when the Adventist folks said to them, now look, you've preached the law of God, why don't you keep the law of God that you preach about? Well, how are they going to escape from the problem? They did so by casting out the law and the Sabbath together. And they said the law is no longer binding. And they used such texts as Galatians 3:19, 2 Corinthians 3, verse 3, and was the other one I'm thinking of, and also Galatians 3 verses 24 and 25, which talk about the law being our schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. When we come to Christ, we're no longer under a schoolmaster. And I'm sure you all remember the studies we've given on the law in Galatians, which are very, very wonderful truths indeed. Now, when they cast out the law and the Sabbath together, then they opened the door for the tremendous development of iniquity and rebellion and sin which we find in the world today. I'll read that now in the book Great Controversy, so we can see that this rejection of the Sabbath leads to this problem, which will then lead, of course, to still deeper problems. I turn across to page 585. Page 585. Perhaps I'll go back to page 584. Wherever the divine precepts are rejected, sin ceases to appear sinful or righteousness desirable. Those who refuse to submit to the government of God are wholly unfitted to govern themselves. Through their pernicious teachings, the spirit of insubordination is implanted in the hearts of children and youth who are naturally impatient of control, and a lawless, licentious state of society results. Now this is a very interesting sentence which I'd like to go back over for a moment. Through their pernicious teachings, the spirit of insubordination is implanted in the hearts of children who are naturally impatient of control. And a natural impatience of control is what? The spirit of disobedience, right. Now, to that is added the spirit of insubordination. And you might say, well, what's the difference? In a sense, there isn't too much difference. But at the same time, obviously, of course, the pernicious teachings develop in those who have the spirit of disobedience, a spirit of insubordination, which is the rejection of all authority. And children cast off the restraint of parents and teachers and so forth. Now it goes on to say, and a lawless, licentious state of society results. While scoffing at the credulity of those who obey the requirements of God, the multitudes eagerly accept the delusions of Satan. They give the rein to lust and practice the sin which have called down judgments upon the heathen. Now, I thought it was my mind at this point. We have been saying up until this point that if Jacob and his mother had said to God, now, Lord, that is your problem and that is your responsibility, then there never would have been any Jacob's trouble, right? Now, at the same time, we must recognize that that Esau's course of action was another mighty factor in that time of trouble. Because if Esau had been the Christian that Jacob ought to have been, if Esau had come back and said, if Esau had said to his father, now look, Dad, Yes, I know that you want to give me the birthright, but look, let's be honest about the fact I don't qualify, do I? I've been a reprobate, I've married the daughters of Heth, I've esteemed the birthright very lightly, I just don't qualify. And let Jacob have it. Now, if he'd taken that stand, of course, again there would have been no Jacob's trouble, would there? So both brothers were at fault. And what we're now reading about in the book Great Controversy, of course, is the fault which lies upon the side of the world as they develop this spirit of lawlessness and hatred of restraint, yet at the same time desire to have the prosperity which belongs only to an obedient people. Now read a little further, page 585 in the book Great Controversy. Those who teach the people to regard lightly the commandments of God sow disobedience to reap disobedience. Let the restraint imposed by the divine law be wholly cast aside, and human laws would soon be disregarded. Because God forbids dishonest practices, coveting, lying, and defrauding, men are ready to trample upon his statutes as a hindrance to their worldly prosperity. But the results of banishing these precepts would be such as they do not anticipate. If the law were not binding, why should any fear to transgress? Property would no longer be safe. Men would obtain their neighbours' possessions by violence, and the strongest would become richest. Life itself would not be respected. The marriage vow would no longer stand as a sacred bulwark to protect the family. He who had the power would, if he desired, take his neighbour's wife by violence. The fifth commandment would be set aside with the fourth. Children would not shrink from taking the lives of their parents if by so doing they could obtain the desire of their corrupt hearts. The civilised world would become a horde of robbers and assassins, and peace, rest and happiness would be banished from the earth. Now this is the outworking of this. It's not the only outworking. In other words, when they teach disobedience, what do they sow? Disobedience, right? And insubordination. And all the lawlessness, dissipation and corruption we find in the world today is the direct result of the teaching of the Protestant and Catholic churches that the law of God is no longer binding. As time goes by, this is going to become worse and worse. Now, attended upon it will be the increasing power of spiritualism, which in turn, of course, will open the door for Satan's mighty working and vastly increase the world's problems. Now, I want to, before I get that farther, I'd like to read a little more on page 587, where we read these words in regard to increasing lawlessness. And as the claims of the fourth commandment are urged upon the people, it is found that the observance of the seventh-day Sabbath is enjoined, and is the only way to free themselves from a duty which they are unwilling to perform. Many popular teachers declare that the law of God is no longer binding. Thus they cast away or aside the law and the Sabbath together. As the work of Sabbath reform extends, this rejection of the divine law to avoid the claims of the fourth commandment will become well nigh universal. The teachings of religious leaders have opened the door to infidelity, to spiritualism, and to contempt for God's holy law, and upon these leaders rests a fearful responsibility for the iniquity which exists in the Christian world. Now, in other words, where we're going, and I'll just mention this before our time runs out, where we're going is to show that all the seed sown by these churches in abandoning the law of God and its restraints is leading to a problem situation of such magnitude and such universality throughout the entire world, that this will bring to a head the final events and will bring to a head the conflict between Jacob and Esau in these last days. That's where we're going. So I just mentioned that before we close the study period, so you get some sort of picture of where we are going in the study. The rejection of the law fills the world with terrorism, with lawlessness, licentiousness and all that iniquity. But at the same time, it also brings economic ruin. It also brings a derangement of nature. It also brings all the calamities and troubles of our present world today, so that as this problem builds up in the world, it imposes upon the world the desire to do something to correct all these troubles. And that will lead up then to the actual time of Jacob's trouble, in which God's folk will expose the false foundations upon which this last grand problem-solving scheme shall be based. And that will plunge them into the time of Jacob's trouble, as Esau regards them as being a threat to his prosperity. But for now, our time is gone, so I'll have to stop right here. And we'll continue this same theme when we come back to our next study period. And we'll learn very soon how it is that the people of God war against God himself during Jacob's trouble. Right, any questions you'd like to ask? Yes.
Within this movement, where they're going to...
Well, yes, certainly.
Although the law, we have the law, this movement, as far as, but if it's not with us, then how does that
Well, in the end, of course, any foolish version amongst us who doesn't have in him or her the spirit of obedience and doesn't get that spirit of obedience will end up being a Judas or a traitor to the cause of God in the end. Actually, I think that the Lord is keeping this movement fairly clean, because we have siftings from time to time, and those who don't go along with the message and don't experience it drop away. But certainly during the loud cry period, there'll be thousands upon thousands come in, and when the storm bursts toward the end of probationary time, most of those will go out again and become our worst and most bitter opponents, as you read in the book Great Controversy. Well, modern Seventh-day Adventism and modern Protestantism is one thing. There's no difference. Mm-hmm. No difference at all. They're all in a totally and hopelessly apostate situation.
Is it possible that those that can come up with their own devotional studies are going to fall under the Esau and the
Oh, yeah, those who get their own message up and try and promote their own message in opposition to what God is giving to us will end up like Judas, as traitors to the cause, become our worst enemies. Today they learn all they can about us, and when they go to war against us, they know as much as they need to know to become our worst enemies.
Yeah.
Any further questions? Now, we're moving along in a certain direction, which I hope you can sort of see where we're going. And when this all comes to a focal point, then we'll really understand what Jacob's trouble is all about, and you find a very, very helpful, I think, revelation. All right, then, it's now about 4 minutes to 11, 3 minutes to 5 minutes to 11, yeah. I'm getting so blind I have to look at everything through glasses anymore.